Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Sianspo Research Podcast, the podcast when we talk to researchers about their studies of the most important issues of our times. In this season, in the first season of the podcast, we talk about environmental transformation. This is the final episode of the season, and here we talk to Alexander Etkin, who is a professor of international relations at the Central European University. Previously, he was a chair at European University Institute in Florence. Alexander now has launched a very important project, Politics of Anthropocene Interdisciplinary Hub, which is a joint project between CEU and Sciences Po. And we also will discuss his recent book, which is called Russia Against Modernity, which is also focusing on the issue of the relationship between politics and environmental changes. Alexander, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here. It's wonderful to have a research podcast. I admire that.
Thank you. This is my job to talk to researchers. And the question I would like to raise right away is the question related to Bruno Latour, who was also a research vice president, the vice president for research at Sciences Po, who actually started the transformation of research faculty in Sciences Po 15-20 years ago. And one of the things Bruno, who is of course very well known here at Sciences Po in France and in the world as one of the leading thinkers on environmental transition in particular, among other things, one of the concepts that he launched was the concept of Gaia. And since your work is also related to this, I would like to ask you this question. How do you understand the concept of Gaia by Bruno Latour? People in Sciences Po all know it by heart, but not everybody who is listening to us is from Sciences Po.
It's a great concept. It's slightly mythological, very theoretical, but very, very engaging. Gaia is everything alive and on the Earth. Gaia is the Earth along with all living and I guess dead beings, creatures, and nature that feeds us, the atmosphere that we breathe, it's all Gaia. Gaia has a kind of self-sustaining homeostatic mechanisms, so that it's like it has its own immunity system. If there is something wrong within Gaia, it responds. First, probably with toleration, then aggressively, it's like an organism fighting cancer. And I think under this grand picture that Latour drew together with some other famous colleagues, such as James Lovelock, the British researcher, doctor, and actually space engineer, there is a kind of apocalyptic intuition that we, the humans, we are like cancer, that you know are growing uncontrollably, consuming too big part of Gaia, and climate change is an immunity response against us.
Yes, this is either pessimistic or optimistic view on the future of humanity. Some young people say that things are not great and human race may be extinct, but some people say it's probably good for Gaia if people who are a cancer to Gaia will be extinct and replaced by other species.
So I think the idea is that Gaia will put us back on our place.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you, among other things, you worked on the concepts of modernity and you actually came up with this idea of Gaia modernity. Can you tell us more about different kinds of modernity and what is so special about the modernity we are living in and what is the relationship between human modernity and Gaia?
This interest in the concept of modernity is actually quite new to me because this is a book that I wrote during the war, the current war. I started writing this book really like in February 2022, trying to kind of to understand the broader framework, also the roots of the war. Also, the book ends with a sort of prediction of what will happen next. That was my kind of modest invention, my modest sort of finding that the very old and kind of trivial concept of modernity is the right framework for understanding the Russian war in Ukraine. And then, you know, modernity is such an elusive concept, so I had to work with some classics such as Max Weber and some kind of modern thinkers. Bruno Latour also wrote, interestingly, like that we have never been modern. I had to distinguish between different types of modernity. But Rush Against Modernity largely means again, this modernity is our modernity, our new modernity, the modernity we live in, which is very different from the old classical bureaucratic modernity of Max Weber. Well, that's Soviet, but also American, you know, modernity that consisted of massive waste of whatever metals, oil, concrete, etc. They thought that big was beautiful. We think that small is beautiful. There are kind of very different kind of opposite ideas of what is good, what is modern, what is good life, what is modern society, what is modernization. And therefore, I distinguished between paleomodernity, so this kind of classical early 20th century type, and the Soviet Union actually lived with this idea. But this is more than idea, it's also a massive complex of practices. So polymodernity was actually easy to name, but then what is our modernity, the new modernity, the newest one? So is it green modernity? So anyway, I was experimenting with anthro-modernity, like from the Anthropocene, but it didn't really work, obviously. And then I caught this idea of Gaia modernity, modernity of Gaia, which also has this benefit, I think, the concept that it is not only our human modernity, but Gaia also changes historically along with us. And Gaia also modernizes. We modernize Gaia, it sort of regulates or controls us. And this concept embraces both humans and the Earth.
Thank you. As an economist, I would think about the paleomodernity as industrial society transition from, say, farm to factory, which indeed happened since the Industrial Revolution in the UK, and especially in the 20th century, spread around the world, including the Soviet Union, which had a project of becoming an industrial power and military power as well. But indeed, the question is which modernity we live in today when we want to move to post-industrial society, greener society, society based on creativity rather than mass investment in energy and resource-consuming production. And so, indeed, this idea of Gaia modernity is something that we are facing on everyday basis and which we don't understand exactly because it's evolving as we speak, as you mentioned. And so when you named your book Russia Against Modernity, for people who listen to us and can't see the cover, the book is in yellow and blue colors, and it has a rocket and oil-producing plant, oil rigs on the cover. So we'll talk about all of that. But Russia is against which modernity today?
Russia is very much against Gaia modernity. Russia is stuck in paleo modernity, which is not a big you know, this big news, because Russian leaders explicitly say that they are trying to kind of to preserve, to or maybe to restore the traditions and practices of the Soviet Union. And that was, as you said, that was all based on the increasing consumption of energy, burning more oil, more gas, more coal, producing more emissions, and the economic growth fully correlated, entirely correlated with the growth of these emissions. And that's exactly what brought us to our current position.
So basically, Russia wants to go back in time into the 20th century. Interestingly, the second half of 20th century was not just industrialization, but also globalization. And many advancements, many changes that industrialization has launched were driven by the global trade, cross-border investment. And this is also what Russia is walking away from. So interestingly, it may actually go even further back, not to 1960s, but more to 1930s and more even to 1920s. And in that sense, it's not even an industrial society, which is an ideal destination for Russia's rulers, but something completely different, completely less internally consistent, because even that modernity doesn't exist in isolation. Trade, global trade, is a very important part of the paleo-modernity as well. You mentioned that Russian rulers want to go back and they are against Gaia modernity. This is actually a very interesting distinction of Russia's autocracy from some other non-democratic regimes, including, for example, China. Mm-hmm. China is a big polluter, but in China you do have a debate on how to reduce emissions, how to assume global responsibility, how to be a player rather than a denialist regarding global climate change. In Russia, the debate is completely different. So what do you think, why Putin and his regime are so unique in terms of denying climate change and also not doing pretty much anything to help help address this problem?
Yeah, my response is that this all happens because Russia is a petrostate. And the late Soviet Union also was a petrostate. Mm-hmm. If you remember, there was the so-called food program adopted in 1982, which was essentially exchanging oil, the Soviet oil, for American and Canadian, European food. So the Soviet Union was not autarkic, as Sovietologists put it. It was fully dependent on global trade, foreign trade. And it specialized more and more so, increasingly so, in selling its energy, its fossil fuels. And it's an existential interest of these post-Soviet rulers of Russia that they have created to continue this trade, because it gave the lion's share of the state budget and of the actual expenditures that they could afford from the Kremlin, you know, financing the armaments, financing their corruption, financing capital flight. All this money came from oil and gas. And without that, they just would lose their money, would lose their power, and possibly would lose their lives as well. Now, China, as you said, is entirely different. It is the biggest emitter in the world, but it also produces a huge, massive amounts of, say, solar panels. Two-thirds of solar panels that we have here all over Europe came from China. Windmills, all kinds of devices that and wiring that is necessary for all that, for controlling all this. And of course, they need lots of coal to produce that, but they do have a debate, but they also have governmental programs that are quite compatible to what the European Union and the United States have adopted. So there is a proper competition in decarbonization, in climate action, responding to climate change. And Russia is out of this truly modern development, global development. It is out of it because it goes directly against its existential interests as the Russian rulers understand them.
That's true, but there are other petrostates, like Middle Eastern oil monarchies, and they understand that the end of oil age is coming. They understand that the decarbonization is a reality, and they invest in diversification. Successfully or not, sufficiently or not, is a different question. But there are indeed programs of diversification in Emirati economy and Saudi economy, who try to build new industries, who try to move away from dependence on oil exports. Russia has only recently started to announce that. Actually, as recently in 2020, Russia adopted a 15-year energy program, which was talking about long-term investment and so on. And there you would see that Russia doesn't want to reduce production of oil and coal in 15 years between 2020 and 2035. And it almost never mentioned renewable energy in this program. And I think the only thing which changed was 2021 when Russia suddenly announced net zero 2060. And that was probably driven by European policy, which introduced announced carbon border adjustment tax, and suddenly Russia woke up to this. But still, the overall debate is denying climate change. And indeed, as you said, they try to resist this need to change, need to adapt to the realities of Gaia modernity. And here is my question to you. It's not only the government that benefits from oil money, but also it looks like that society is also not very much aware, and we don't have climate protests in Russia. And in that sense, there is something different, not just at the level of the government, but also at the level of ordinary citizens. How do you explain that Russian society as a whole is not participating in this debate?
Very deep question, in fact, and very difficult one. But probably, and the economists know that pretty, you know, in detail, that the Russian society, the people as such, they also benefit, they get a part of this oil revenue that comes from selling fossil fuel. Do they understand that? Do they sort of appreciate it? Are they grateful? That's a different question. And I kind of doubt that they actually realize that a part of their salary comes from oil revenue, or say a good life in Moscow is a part of the functioning of the petrostate. I think that a bigger problem is the Russian education. The school system, the university system, it has diverged dramatically from the European standards. And possibly one could say from the global standards, if there are global standards at all. And this divergence also is tragic. It's a big part of, you know, the current war. The divergence in educational practices, standards, ideas that's been transmitted by the state institutions, such as school, the university system, also say the army and the prison, because they are also responsible for educating their contingents. When it will all change, things will have to be a start from scratch.
Right. This is a very worrisome tendency, because for me, this war is also partly driven by Russian school education system, where people studied wrong history textbooks. And in that sense, what you're saying also suggests that this problem will remain with us for a long, long time. On an optimistic note, younger people also get information through social media, through internet. And in that sense, for you, should we think that there is still a generational divide, so younger people are better aware, more aware of the climate change and the need for action? To what extent do you think that despite the school system, which remains antiquated and stuck in Soviet times, do you think there is a hope for the younger generation of Russians?
There is a hope. And of course, there is a generational divide. And we see it in, you know, many events. Say this massive emigration that happened when, you know, Putin announced partial mobilization, more than 1 million of young Russians, young, you know, males with their families. They have fled, seeking good life, but actually life without whatever jobs, salaries, and in, you know, new places is very difficult. So that was driven by their really ideas or resistance to Putin's war. I would rather doubt this idea that it is mostly about, say, history textbooks. It's about many, many other textbooks. They study biology, they study chemistry. There are subjects, you know, the Soviet education was actually strong on natural sciences. And of course, climate science is a big, big part of it. And social sciences is also nowadays very much about the Anthropocene and the transformation of the environment. that this should be taught, I think, from the kindergarten. And there are, you know, very easy things to do, like what to do with the garbage, how to sort it out. And that all has not happened in Russia. Just has not come. And in my book, I'm trying to explain it's not only by just the bad aspects of the educational system, which is also, you know, depends on the ministries, on the teachers, on the continuity of the Soviet tradition as well. But also I'm looking at the family structure, the absence of males, the domination of grandmothers in the so-called nuclear family, which is not really nuclear in Russia. So there's cultural innovations, like sorting out garbage, and many, many other things, whatever, contraceptives, internet skills. So they come not from parents to children, but from grandparents to grandchildren, which slows them down by the fact of two. It just decelerates the whole historical process.
So to explain to our audience, in Russia, the nuclear family is often not a father, mother, and child. And just to be clear, same-sex marriages are outlawed in Russia. Right. And actually, even talking about same-sex marriages can land you in prison because there is a special law on homosexual propaganda, homosexuals exactly. propaganda, gay propaganda. So it's a very, officially, it's a very homophobic country. But nuclear family is a same-sex family with a grandmother and mother and a child or children, where mother, by the virtue of not having a second source of income, spends a lot of time at work or several jobs. And it is grandmother who is in charge of upbringing of the new generation, which indeed explains how Alexander just mentioned the transmission of values and the cultural innovation that you mentioned. It's a super interesting point that shows how all different disciplines are connected when we talk about those issues. Indeed, I raised the issue of history, and you're right that social science in general are very important because Russia is a unique country which is very authoritarian despite being very educated. But this education is, as you said, is mostly in natural sciences, while social sciences are very weak. And that may explain why people don't understand the need for change, the need for collective action as well. Now, that brings me to this issue of interdisciplinarity. When we talk about climate, when we talk about Gaia modernity, we need to connect a lot of dots. And in your work, you looked at the issue of inequality and you looked at the issue of imperialism related to the issue of Russia against modernity. So what is the inequality dimension of this?
Inequality is an essential feature of petrostates states. This income that comes from oil and gas business is particularly obscure. It's kind of easy to conceal, to hide the kind of profits, to export these profits, to get rich duchesses and villas and yachts out of this kind of concealed barrels. And this indeed, as you said, that happens not only in Russia, but in Russia because of its probably just because of this two or three decades of the non-changing power, which is kind of world record in our current modern world. So it has come to the extreme, but also the scale of things, this uncontrollability, centralization, Moscow versus the actual sources of wealth, which is far over there in West Siberia. And the whole construction is based on kind of very shaky foundations. From the start of the post-Soviet transformation, the main issues were about the local rebellions against the Moscow power in the Caucasus, the First Chechen War, the Second Chechen War. And of course, historically, it's very clear that the military victories in Chechnya coincided or actually led to the consolidation of the authoritarian rule in Moscow. And I actually foresee that this centrifugal tendencies, like that would go kind of different parts of Russia will try to get out of this situation, and that's been all triggered by the war. If there were no war, in a kind of quiet.
You talk about 2022 war.
2014 to now.
Mm-hmm.
It's now already.
Many
years of this war, but of course it has, you know, culminated in 2022.
I wanted to mention that because indeed sometimes people talk about the war, but forget that this war against Ukraine started a long time ago.
Yeah,
2014. Yeah,
that's important kind of historical perspective on that. But it has triggered this centrifugal tendencies, which I believe they would actually, if it continues like this, it could be stopped somehow. Well, hope it will be stopped, say by the military victory of Ukraine, but we don't see it happening today. And if it continues like this, I predict an actual dismembering, like disintegration of the Russian Federation. But of course, the Russian rulers also see that. And the ruling party in Russia, you know, trying to find the proper name for itself, called itself United Russia, not like whatever, beautiful Russia or whatever, just Russia. There's also such party, a minority one. But United Russia, that's their main purpose, main ideal, possibly the only idea that they have.
That's actually interesting because what you're talking about is a petro state, which only needs pretty much West Siberia and Moscow. And in that sense, there is a very interesting anecdote in Russian political thought when they hired a general who could read minds of Western politicians. I'm not kidding. That is an official interview with this general who read the mind of Margaret Thatcher. And he read there that she thinks that Russia needs only 15 million people and not more. Because that what is needed to serve the needs of Russian oil industry. But from what you're talking about, it follows that maybe the same thinking is going on in the minds of Kremlin rulers themselves. Margaret Thatcher never said that, and probably have never thought that, but probably Putin is thinking like this. And this is my question to you. Wouldn't Putin be happier if he keeps the oil, has enough money, so he preserves his palaces, and that's great. What's not to like? Why would he need to start this war if oil was still there? And with all the climate action, probably the peak oil, the end of oil era, will come after Putin is gone. So why do you think the petrostate came to 2014 and 2022?
Another very difficult question. I kind of would start from a word of doubt that you said that this petrostate would need Siberia and Moscow. Why would they need Moscow?
Siberia? I agree because I think for Putin, well, Putin would probably even prefer St. Petersburg, but he needs a palace and he needs to be closer to Sardinia, which is his preferred destination for vacation. So
That's probably true.
West Siberia doesn't provide you with a climate nice enough and location close enough to places where he can consume those billions. And he likes yachts, so he needs a warm sea. So.
He lives there in Moscow. The so-called elite lives there. But in this scheme of things, what is the role of Moscow really? Do they need like an accounting center? Oil goes through pipelines. It used to go through pipelines to Western Europe. Now it goes, through to the harbors near St. Petersburg, and then on tankers it goes all around the world to the harbors of India and China. It could go, first of course, it could go through straight through Siberia, if say China would build these proper pipelines. So if it happens, Moscow is out of business. It just, if they need an accounting center, like proceeding money rather than natural resources. So these Chinese would build their town somewhere on the route.
Chinese viceroy in West Siberia, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So Moscow would be, in this scheme of things, would be just out of business. There is no need in Moscow. And in any scenario of Russia's disintegration, Moscow would suffer the most, more than the Caucasus, more than Siberia, more than Kaliningrad / Königsberg. That's a problem of Moscow. And I mean, I don't want to invest too much sort of IQ into the minds of the Russian leaders, but I think they have this true anxiety about such developments, and they endeavor this preemptive action, which is the war. They knew a lot. So, say, the European Union declared, you know, and basically every year or every several months, they tighten the screw of the European programs of the decarbonization. You know, halving emissions by 2030, bringing them to zero by 2050, that would mean proportionally the cutting of the Kremlin profits. That could not happen, that they didn't want that to happen. They responded first by denial, then by deception, and finally by war.
When we talk about Russia as a petrostate, it is indeed a very unique petrostate which denies modernity, unlike Middle Eastern monarchies and Norway. In Norway, indeed, the sovereign wealth fund, which is formed through selling oil and investing the oil revenues, the Norwegian government is very clear that they want to invest in green industries and not in oil industries. This money should actually decarbonize global economy. Russia doesn't do that. For Russia, the view of the future is completely different. Why and what the national project is for people in the Kremlin?
Their project, their future is continuing their past. And Russia indeed is deeply, deeply different from other petrostates. Because the secret of survival for a petrostate is not using its petro profits. Petrostate has two problems. One is the oil curse, and another is climate change. And only now I understand that these two issues are entirely different, but so closely, tightly connected. So because of the oil curse, say Norway does not spend its money, its oil profits at all. It locks this money in the sovereign fund. Arab countries say they invest in petrochemistry. This petrochemistry will give back profits maybe like 5 or 10 years later. So they also do not spend. They kind of isolate this money. Or they buy armaments, F-35s, etc. It doesn't work. So Russia cannot possibly do that. Russia cannot lock its petro profits in a safe, because then there would be just no other money for the government, for the army, for the people.
Right. So this actually makes Russia so unique and makes it so interesting, not just because it's it belongs to the 20th century with its foreign policy and aggression, which we thought will never happen in the 21st century, but also with its economic policies. Now, we already saw your views on federalization and decolonization on Russia. We didn't talk about other natural resources. There is one important issue, which is diamonds in Yakutia, where you also have the centrifugal tendencies, which are quite strong. But overall, if you were the post-Putin president of Russia or prime minister of Russia, what would you do? This is the question I raise for all my guests.
Oh, I thought that's only for me.
not everybody gets a question on Russia. But since you work on Russia, right. the question is for you, what would you do with Russia?
Okay, I will stop the war immediately. I will bring the troops back to the 1991 borders, which of course also means the liberation of the Crimea and Sevastopol from the Russian troops and the Navy. I will immediately release all political prisoners, and I will run free and transparent elections.
This part is pretty much common, right? But what would you do as a scholar of modernity, environmental transition, imperialism, memory, history, Russia specific?
You know what? But then, like, if I'm this kind of magician, so say then the Russian people would say elect Navalny. So I will resign. Then that would be his job to decide. But then, of course, I will highly recommend him, or would immediately sign all kinds of international treaties, and actually would insist on their implementation, like the Paris Treaty, etc. That would both limit the emissions. And therefore, the export-import of Russian oil and gas. Therefore, it will immediately lead to major economic problems in the whole post-Soviet Russia. And then, of course, we would have to deal with these accelerating problems. I would also send all these, you know, thousands of Russian diplomats, who I think are doing pretty much nothing or doing very, very bad, evil things, to lobby for accepting Russia in the trade emissions schemes. And Russia could indeed, if it is accepted, and if this European and global emission schemes would be changed, they would have to be radically changed, then Russia would get serious money that could replace the lost oil profits because of Russia's territory, its forests, its marshes, its wastelands. That could be turned into use on the global scale. And doing that, I would actually hope that I would preserve Russia, but maybe that would not happen. And I will have no money on my successor to subsidize the Caucasus or Tuva or some other, you know, distant regions, or places like Yakutia, possibly they would have better things, better ideas, what they could do, or say Königsberg. And then I would start negotiating their going away.
Thank you, Alexander. Just to clarify for our listeners, Russia is a big polluter, but actually Soviet Union was even a bigger polluter. And when we fixed the level of emissions in 1990, at that point, Soviet Union was polluting much more than Russia was polluting already a few years later or is polluting today. With all its deficiencies, market economies are more flexible in terms of reducing pollution, and the potential for Russia selling emission quotas is actually huge, and Russia could indeed benefit from this. And on top of that, of course, there is a global interest in making Russia decarbonize, and so we will see a lot of investment coming from Western countries, in particular European Union, helping Russia to become greener. So thank you very much for this conversation, Alexander. That was the last episode on environmental transition. Please stay tuned for the next season, where we will discuss democracy, challenges to democracy, authoritarian regimes, and populist politics.